Well, welcome to the 4th of July edition of After Hours. I hope you're being careful out there. I hope you're having fun if you're outside. One of my bookshelves at home is filled, totally filled with the works of Richard Lindbergh, who I consider one of the great historians in the history of this wild, wacky city. I've known Richard for a long time. I've read him and liked him even longer, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to the air. Richard, it's nice of you to give up. I find this 4th of July pretty strange. I don't know about you, but it has a weird vibe to me.
It's got a weird vibe.
Yeah, doesn't it feel? Yeah. It just doesn't feel like the old days.
No,
I think.
The world's changing, kidding. Rick.
Yeah. I've had Richard on the show many times to talk about his series of I think brilliant historical narratives about everything from mobsters to the White Sox to his own somewhat tortured family history. I read with some alarm, I suppose it was this week, Richard, that you may be retiring from the business of book writing. Did I read that correctly? Or were you drinking or something? Wrote that.
Well, Rick, I call myself semi-retired. I've just ended my employment with the city of Chicago, and 7 years with the city concludes. And you never know, you reach a certain point in life and a certain age when jobs are no longer plentiful. And I'm still full of energy and still full of spirit, and I will never give up writing. It's my life. It defines who I am, and I plan to write more books. I actually would like to take a shot at fiction, something I've never done before, but that's like climbing Mount Everest for a nonfiction writer.
Do you feel, have you quit your last job? Are you done? You don't have to go in Tuesday, do you?
No, that's the strange thing, not going in Tuesday.
Wow.
I had worked 4 years in City Hall as Alderman
sure.
Ed Burke's speechwriter.
Yeah.
And of course, that all changed, and I ended up getting transferred to utility billing and customer service that handles the water billing for Chicago. And I had a transitory job there, moving a program over from City Hall into that department, and pretty much it was a temporary thing. I knew it was going to end, and I got extended twice, and the position was formally eliminated. And then I stood on the corner. I stood outside, and I thought to myself, "What's next?"
Wow!
Remembering Tom Hanks in that movie where he got rescued from the desert island.
Right.
And at the end of the movie, standing at four crossroads, and he's not sure of where he's going and what direction. And
in some ways, Richard, that can be. I don't know whether it's sunk in. That can be kind of liberating, can it not?
Well, yeah, I guess in one sense it can. But Rick, I've had a job for 52 years.
I know.
And every book I've written has been written around a full-time job.
Yep.
And, you know, you get on that treadmill and you complain about it and you think, oh my, you know, if I were retired. And then all of a sudden that long journey down the river ends, and then suddenly you're on shore again and you're thinking, gee, you know, am I going to miss this?
You
become so attuned to getting
yeah.
at a certain time. And especially now, I mean, I'm probably taking a little more harder than a lot of people would who just joyfully look forward to retirement, because I've always had a frantic schedule, and not having a frantic schedule, you know, is kind of disconcerting.
Well, you and I, there are a ton of similarities, and I want all of you sometime later tonight or tomorrow when you're off Monday to go to Richard's website. There's a brilliant thing about what some of his influences are, and you and I share so many of these influences, down to the great John O'Hara, who is one of the most one of the most overlooked and diminished writers. I think Appointment in Samar is one of the greatest novels I've ever read.
Pottstown, Pennsylvania, he came
yeah.
from, and he's completely forgotten today. But in his time, his books were turned into motion pictures. Ten
yep.
North Frederick, Butterfield 8. But critics have not been kind. They looked upon him kind of like a a Jacqueline Suzanne or Howard Robbins kind of writer.
Yes,
but he was prolific, and he had a great deal of art to what he did.
Oh, I agree. And one of the problems with O'Hara was that he was a really, really, really nasty drunk who seemed to have a insecurity complex. I think there's a story, Richard. I think it was Hemingway and talking to Faulkner. Hemingway and Fitzgerald are talking, and someone said, "What do you think? What should we buy John for his birthday?" And I think it was Hemingway who suggested, "Let's get him a diploma from Princeton, because that's what he wants more than anything." I'm going to spend this whole hour talking, and we're going to mention all of his books with Richard Lindbergh, who you can find at richardlindbergh.net. He is free and clear now, and I'm very curious. We're going to go back into, because I think he decided to become a writer at the Roosevelt Theater when he sat there and watched Jason Robards pretend to be Al Capone in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
That was my Al Capone inspiration.
1967. Well, better than most. We'll be back in a couple minutes with Richard. He'll be here for the whole hour, and I appreciate it, Richard, very much.
Thank you.
It all began, ladies and gentlemen, in 1967, I would pin to that date, at the bygone Roosevelt Theater downtown, where young Richard Lindbergh saw the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and began to realize, I guess you began to realize at that time, that, oh my God, I'm surrounding by all this living history and all these strange characters. In so doing, Richard, in realizing that, did you immediately start to write, or did you see, how did it affect you at the time?
Well, I had been writing. I actually started at age 11 keeping a diary. On January 1st, 1965, mm-hmm. I was in fifth grade,
yep.
And I started keeping a diary, and I have kept a diary ever since. I thought I was approaching a world record, but I looked up on the internet and found out that the actual world's record is like 90 years of keeping a diary.
Unpublished, I'm assuming, yeah. The diary, in many ways, and I don't want to, you have written about it later in your career. You had what you consider a kind of tough, dark childhood. Captured remarkably in a book called Whiskey Breakfast. But was writing an escape for you, Richard Lindbergh?
Oh, gosh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a familiar story that people who know me, I always relate. I read The Diary of Anne Frank when I was in fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And sixth or whatever. It might have been fifth, might have been sixth, maybe even seventh. I don't know. But I'll never forget my teacher. Her name was Mrs. Golden, and she comes up to me. I had done a book report on it, and I had handed it to her. She read it, and she scribbled on there "U" for unsatisfactory, and said, "Young man, you are not capable of writing like this."
Oh, God.
And she says, "You copied this off of a dust jacket." And I said, "No, I didn't." She says, "Oh, don't tell me, because there's 15 editions of this book out there. You could have had any kind of dust jacket." I said, "It's an original composition." And that was the first inkling I had that maybe I have something that I could actually publish down the road. You know, it was that was kind of a negative inspiration. When I went to high school, I had a junior year English teacher, and she came up to me and she says, "Rich," she says, "you know, are you going to college?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't think I can afford it. I don't have any scholarship prospects, et cetera, et cetera." And she said, "You know, you have to go to college. You just have to go." She says, "Because you write well." And she says, "You have a gift for it." And that was the very first time that I had positive feedback that I thought I could do this. So I thought to myself, somehow, some way, I'm going to become a writer.
Well,
and
I got to tell you, that first teacher, that is an unbelievably cruel thing to say to some young person. An unbelievably cruel thing. Thank God you got the second one to give you some inspiration.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was kind of a Dickensian childhood.
Yeah.
I had a crazy family, and the father married four times, and I had, he was a I guess politely put, a conscientious objector from Sweden, and he came in illegally into the United States in the 1920s and avowed socialist all his life, but yet lived the life of an arch capitalist and had his own business. And it was always contradiction in terms for everything. But you know, through the madness and craziness, the only defining thing I had in life was my writing and keeping a journal. And I think that journaling is so important for anybody who aspires to write, because it's a training ground. You know, more important, I think, than taking writing classes or going to workshops. I never found a workshop to be productive enough to actually inspire a book.
Well, it's also, you know, it's also, and I've seen this in youth poetry organizations, it's also a way to express yourself at a time when teenagers expressing themselves are not met with, you know, standing ovations. You know what I mean? They're met with, "You're crazy. Why do you think this way?" When did you buckle down, Richard Lindbergh?
My first writing job was, like many aspiring Chicago journalists and reporters, the Old Learner newspaper chain, which spawned the likes of Mike Royko and
Bill Brasher,
and many others. And I was covering Northwest Side general news stories, school board meetings. I was doing that around a full-time job with Sears Roebuck. Then I later did the sports beat, you know, which was amounted to calling coaches, football coaches, on Sunday morning, the day after they had lost a game, and they're in no mood to talk to you on deadline at 9 o'clock on Sunday.
Brother, that's tough duty. That's tough.
But you know what? Learner was a shop that produced a lot of great talent.
Oh, no question. Did you, starting at Learner, did you aspire to, you know, one of these so-called downtown papers? I mean, did you think of yourself as a budding working journalist?
Oh yeah, Rick, I sent so many resumes to the three Chicago dailies, and then of course we lost the Daily News.
Yeah,
I never forget the story, and I guess the big mistake I made was not being aggressive enough. My friend and colleague, Geraldine Kolarik,
I know her well,
books.
Sure.
Yeah, she was a news editor at Channel 2, and she told me that her first major gig was with City News Bureau, and she went in there and got an interview, and the interview wasn't going real well, and she took out a pair of handcuffs, and she handcuffed herself to the doorknob in Dornfeld's office and said, "You know, I'm not leaving until you hire me."
And they did, and Darnie did?
And they did. You know, only in Chicago can you hear a story like that.
Yeah,
and I
really
think to myself, you know, damn, if I wish I had a pair of handcuffs, because I would have done the same thing. But I was just firing resumes into newsrooms through the U.S. mail, and they get 1,000 resumes a day.
The interesting thing is, you and I have seen this city, and I know it's interesting now that you have stopped working full time at another sort of profession, as you have done throughout your entire writing career, that you will start to drift back, and some of these memories will come back to you, and some of them will be shadowed by regret. Like, I wish I had. Do you have any of that, Richard?
Every single day.
Yeah.
I look at all the jobs I had, and I think to myself, boy, did I screw that one up. I think my biggest issue was when I was working for Sears. I thought to myself, that was going to be the rest of my life. I was going to be working for Sears, getting falling arches, standing on my feet, selling refrigerators at Irving Park and Cicero. I did not aggressively go after the writing world as much as I think I should have now. You know, that's my biggest regret. Like I said, the old handcuff trick in Dornfeld's office, that might have worked. Who knows?
You didn't have any handcuffs. You didn't have any handcuffs.
No, I didn't. But, you know, we all have regrets in this.
Sure.
We look to the future. I guess I'm kind of a optimistic, negative kind of person in a sense. I mean, the glass is half full sometimes and half empty the others.
Yep.
You know, and then you think, well, you're just about ready to give it up. but then something new comes along.
Yeah.
And I'm always encouraged by the words of Dickens' character and David Copperfield, Mr. Micawber, the penniless optimist who said, "Oh, hold on, baby, my boy. Tomorrow something may turn up." And more often than not in life, that is a very true thing. Things have turned up for me. And
In most cases, though, in your case, you've made them turn up.
You have to work hard, and you have to work really hard in this business, in any creative business,
be it
music, art, journalism, poetry, nonfiction writing. The world isn't handed to you on a silver platter, and you got to work hard for it, and you got to imagine. It starts with imagination, and then it continues with ambition.
Toss in there too, because I think this is one of the hallmarks of your career and work is curiosity.
I think
curiosity has been a motivating factor for you. You've come up with not only interesting, there's a two-volume set of books called Return to the Scene of the Crime, A Guide to Infamous Places in Chicago, which is just one of the great, first of all, it's one of the great ideas. And you pulled it off as capably as one could imagine. So you got to toss curiosity into your quiver, don't you?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Because when I read of these famous events in Chicago history, I said, I want to go look at these places, and I want to see what they're about.
Yeah.
And I went after looking after old buildings where infamy occurred and where history occurred and where people lived. And just looking at these buildings and touching them, and it goes back to the St. Valentine's Day Massacre story.
Sure.
The day after, the very same day I saw the movie at the Roosevelt,
wow.
I took the bus up to 2122 Clark Street.
Yes, sir.
This was in June of 1967, 1 month before the garage where the massacre occurred was torn down.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember standing in front of that building. It was an antiques building. The Werner family owned it.
Yeah.
The window was grimy. You could barely see through it. It was just an old, dumpy looking little warehouse, and I was peering inside, you know, just through the grimy glass, trying to see what was in there. And there was an empty lot next door to the north, and there were bricks laying around there. And I picked up a brick. It wasn't for this building, but there was a brick for the building that had been there next to it.
Yeah.
So I took that brick home as a souvenir. And that kind of showed me, you know, that history is real and it's alive.
Oh, that's great.
So I conceived Return to the Scene of the Crime. When I went to New York, I found a little book about the crimes of Manhattan. It was a walking tour, and it took me past the building where Evelyn Nesbit had her tryst with Stanford White, the architect who was murdered on the rooftop of Madison Square Garden. And I'm looking at this little sliver building. It was crunched between two enormous skyscrapers.
Huh.
And the Red Velvet Swing scenario was in the top floor. And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking to myself, boy, you know, I could really do a book on Chicago's infamous places. New York's got nothing on Chicago.
Oh, nothing on Chicago. when listening to Richard Lindbergh, you really do get a sense of his passion for what he does. We got to take a break and get some news in here about shootings and other things, and we'll be back to talk about more of his books and his life as an author. It's not easy. It's not easy out there, and it's gotten increasingly difficult. So please stay tuned. We'll get the news, and then we'll be back. I have my friend and the great author Richard Lindbergh till 6 o'clock. Richard, it's impossible to cover your entire career in an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours or even 4 hours. When did you publish your first book? Give me the background on the first published book.
Oh, my. The one I most want to forget. That was in 1978. I was working at Sears Roebuck at Irving Park, and there was a little magazine store directly across the street. And I used to go there on my lunch hour. They sold paperbacks and magazines. And I saw a little interesting little baseball paperback by a guy named Rick Schwab it was called Stuck on the Cubs. It was the humorous reflections of a lifelong Cub fan. Well, I thought to myself, I can give the humorous reflections of a lifelong White Sox fan.
Sure.
And, you know, it was a little kind of Ma and Pa thing. Rick's brother had published Stuck in the Cubs. So I queried him on it, and I said, would you like a companion volume? And he did. Uh-huh. And we published this terrible little paperback. I'm not good at writing humor, and I'll never forget Clarence Peterson reviewed it in the Tribune, and first book review I ever got, and Clarence Peterson was not very kind, and I guess deservedly so. He said, this is a collection of unfunny essays paralleling Stuck in the Cubs, and I was crimson and mortified, and I will never forget. I swore to myself I was going to make this up, and I was going to do a decent book on the White Sox. And a couple years later, I came out with another hardcover book called "Who's on Third: The Chicago White Sox Story."
Sure.
And there were a few more after that. And then I decided, well, I don't want to be known as the White Sox guy.
Right.
So I turned to my other love, Chicago history, and I produced a book called Chicago Ragtime, which is still in print as Chicago by Gaslight, which was a collection of stories about Chicago and its formative years. You know, the period that your dad most loved.
Sure, sure.
The end of the Civil War up to the 1920s. And I guess imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, because I had a chapter in there called "The Summer of Lost Innocence" about 1919 and all the horrific things that happened.
Yeah, what a year!
Yeah, and it inspired a book a few years ago, just a book about the summer of 1919. And I was in the bibliography, and I thought to myself, boy, this guy, took my story, which is what happens. I mean,
sure,
you know, as a nonfiction writer, you know, you have no copyright on history.
Yep.
But I guess when you see your story picked up, you realize, well, you had a pretty good story to begin with.
Yeah.
And so that was how it started. And then I began churning them out one after another.
Just like the first experience of Clarence Peterson, who I knew pretty well. Clarence Peterson became then that horrible teacher in grammar school, saying the cruel teacher. But you kept at it. I ever thought, Richard, man, with almost every one of your books, I thought, man, all this book needs is a little more promotion, a little more. Maybe it needs a New York publisher in those days. And you can break through and you can become a writer full time. Did that ever, were you ever close to doing that?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, for me, New York has been a glass ceiling. I've gone to that well, Rick, so many times, and you get the same response to every idea. Well, you know, that's
too
local, about Chicago.
Too local,
it's regional, won't have much of a national sell. We used to publish books like that before, but the title list has shrunk. I came close with Shattered Sense of Innocence, the book about the 1955 Schussler-Peterson murders. We had a Los Angeles agent representing us,
mm-hmm.
and it got a really good look in New York. And ultimately, we ended up with Southern Illinois University Press.
Sure.
And they did a fine job. But, you know, with a university press, you don't get the publicity.
You don't get the promotional muscle and the promotional
money. No, you don't get
money.
The book reviews.
Yeah.
You don't get a whole lot of talk shows other than your great program.
Well.
And by the way, you recognize Chicago authors, and that's just a tremendous thing, Rick.
I love all authors. My father was a Chicago author. I think of myself as a Chicago author. And I understand, as you do, how difficult it is to get noticed in this Twitter universe we live in, that it's, you know, people.
Well, it takes a body of work.
Yeah.
I get so many people who contact me about, they have a book idea, they want to get published, they want the quickest, fastest path to New York, they want an agent. And I tell them, you know, it's just not that easy. I mean, the catch-22 is you can't get published unless you have an agent,
right.
And you can't have an agent unless you've been published.
Right.
And
you and I have seen the whole book publishing industry flipped on its rear end. Now there are a lot of self-published books that are doing well. There are just so many more avenues with which to do this. And Richard and I come from the old days where if a New York agent picks you up, they will get you with a New York publisher and you might sell a few copies of your book. It's just, it's tougher, I think, than it's ever been. Do you agree with that, Richard?
Yeah. And it doesn't get easier. I think the shift really began in the 1980s and early 90s, when all the great little houses in New York that published edgier kind of material were bought up by the big New York, European houses like Bertelsmann, and the consolidation of the industry in New York made it impossible for a lot of writers to break through.
And, you know, they were all looking. The other thing was that all of these publishing houses increasingly are looking for the one blockbuster. Publishers used to, they might take a flyer on a Richard Lindbergh or a Rick Kogan book that they thought, well, okay, maybe this isn't going to sell 100,000 copies, but let's nurture this writer and let's give him some confidence and let's hope the next book sells 100,000 copies. That doesn't exist anymore.
Well, there's no more Maxwell Perkins type of editors and publishing execs like that anymore. You know, when you think of Thomas Wolfe and you think of Fitzgerald and The Lost Generation and the kind of backgrounds they came from, especially Thomas Wolfe from North Carolina, and Maxwell Perkins edited like a 150,000-word manuscript into a manageable length. And who has time now at New York publishing houses to do that, let alone show the interest and recognize the talent in a writer like Thomas Wolfe?
It's kind of, I find it modestly depressing, frankly.
It's hugely depressing.
Incredibly depressing.
But you know what? We never give up. You know, because, like I said, you never know what will turn up tomorrow. Opportunity does present, and when I talk to a lot of first-time authors and people who are thinking about it, I just ask them to be realistic about the business and understand you're not going to hit it the first time. And what is your motive? Do you want to write for the sake of the art, or do you want to write just to make money? And if the answer is money, then play the stock market, because not going to happen in publishing.
Go play dice in an alley somewhere.
It's an art. And like any other art, you do it because you have a profound respect for it, and you love it, and you recognize its intrinsic beauty. That's why you do it. I think Stephen King often pulls the question, why do we do it? We do it for that reason. You know, and success is often an incidental happy outcome, but it's not the motivation for the true writer for what he does.
It's certainly not. And you have become such a part of this local world. I know you speak at libraries all the time, and you speak at bookstores like the Great Centuries and Sluice. And you felt comfortable in that community, and the books give you entree into that community. And I think people ask you all the time. I can't even imagine how many queries you get about, hey, Mr. Lindbergh, I loved your book. Can you read the five chapters of my book and tell me what to do? It's a little crazy. It's a little crazy. Now we're gonna look to the future. I'm going to take a very short little commercial break and come back to you, Richard, and we'll talk about talk about what's next. I mean, you know, it could be you pick up a newspaper and you see a story that intrigues you and you want to follow through. We'll figure that out. I'm not going to plot the course of your future, but I'm curious about what you're thinking. We'll be right back. Those of you who have tomorrow or some of tomorrow off, you might want to spend some of that time going to Richard Lindbergh, LindBerg.net to explore some of the books we've been talking about and some of his other work, and ordering those books and then reading those books. They are basically very Chicago-centric, but he has gotten more artful with each book. He writes with incredible narrative force. I would recommend, it's not too much for you, to start with Whiskey Breakfast, which how much I love that book, Richard. I appreciate how unbelievably difficult that book must have been to write for you. But I also have the feeling, since you mentioned at the beginning of the show, that you might like to tackle a novel now. I've got to believe that there is material in your personal history that would lend itself to a novel. What do you think? Is that too difficult, too?
Well, with nonfiction, you have it all laid out in front of you.
Yeah.
And your challenge is to uncover the hidden nuggets of,
right,
of
right.
forgotten history. With a novel, you have a broad canvas to paint on. And I find that the several attempts that I've made, is it's difficult for me to formulate plot, to move forward. But I'm always looking for ideas, and I scan various media. And I have started a novel, actually. I read some years ago, I read a marvelous book called Time and Again by Jack Finney, who mm-hmm. wrote The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And he wrote a time travel story that goes back to New York in 1882. It was, it's at the top of my reading list. I reread the book three or four times.
Wow.
What a marvelous, engaging mystery and historical mystery and recreation of a long-lost era. And I thought, boy, you know, that's the kind of book I want to write. And hats off to Jack Finney. He wrote a sequel to it, but unfortunately he died before publication.
Huh.
And his family finished it off, and it has a kind of a muddled, confused
sure.
ending. But the first book was just a tour de force. And yeah, that's the kind of book I want to write. I want to write about Chicago in the old days. And by the old days, I mean its robust era.
Post-fire.
1990s yeah. and 1900s. And, that's my period. I love that period. I look at the old buildings on South Dearborn Street, you know, the Manhattan Building and the Fisher Building, and then I drive around and I see 19th century buildings scattered here and there, and I wonder, gee, who lived there? And the building has a history of life to it, you know, and who are some of the people? And that sparks curiosity, and that sparks the thought process.
It's like, who killed who in that building?
Oh.
Who killed who in that building? See, that's the other thing. When you have time to, you know, really take a deep breath after stopping your straight jobs after 50-some years of working your straight jobs, you're going to find that even that swirling around your head are all sorts of characters. I mean, you could list them. I asked you to list them now. You could probably list them all, but you don't know what form they're going to take and what shape they're going to take.
And every character in fiction, I don't care what the author says, is based upon somebody they know or somebody they have read about or somebody in real life.
Yeah.
Fiction is not really made up, because I think it really is the collective memory of every author and the people he knew personally and his experiences. So a lot of the author goes into every novel. And I'm reading a book right now called Poor No More by Robert Ruark, a completely mm-hmm. forgotten author. And he wrote a 600-page opus about the rise of and fall of a poor kid who becomes a tycoon. And it's kind of a Harold Robbins type
yeah,
of book.
Yeah.
But you know, I look for the author in the story. And you have to look for the author in every good novel, because their voice is behind the voice of the characters that they create.
Then no question.
Yeah.
So what are you going to, while you're sitting around and trying to figure out what the next novel will be, or the next book that will bring you to my show again, what are you going to do with all that? You know, that's 8-10 hours a day where you used to work at selling refrigerators at Sears and helping Alderman Burke do what Alderman Burke does, and a variety of other things, a lot of time in real estate.
Yeah.
Have you thought about what you're going to do with those 10 or so hours you're going to have free every day?
Well, I do
read.
Have some
you're
writing
reading,
projects.
Obviously.
I've done some institutional histories for a company called Donning out in Missouri,
mm-hmm.
and they hire authors to write histories of companies, of universities, of clubs, institutions, and I got a gig lined up to do a golf club in Northeast Ohio, the Kirtland Country Club, and I've just finished a book for them on the North Dakota Farmers Union Mutual Insurance Company.
Wow.
Without having visited North Dakota during the pandemic, I managed to cobble together the book for them.
How interesting.
Oh, yeah. And Donning does those kinds of books, and I'm one of the stable of writers that they hire for this. And so I guess that will become my day job.
Sure.
While I continue on with doing the other kinds of books that I really want to write.
Is it rewarding, that kind of, you did history of your university
yes.
not long ago, and I which is also a very good book.
Thank you.
Is it rewarding on the creative level for you?
Well, you have to fire the creative juices.
Yeah.
You have to look at an institution, a university, a business, and understand, like everything else, they have a history,
yeah,
and they have anecdotes, and they have people associated with who have colorful stories,
sure,
to share. So you have to go into what I call the zone. You have to kind of tune things out and zero in and focus on finding a great story to tell. And usually with the individuals that I've interviewed, their stories have always some good nuggets of color to it, and you build around the color, and then you tell a larger story. So you have to immerse yourself in the subject. That,
yeah,
is the most important thing. And you have to, even if the subject sounds inherently dry, you have to find the aspects that are colorful and interesting, and then you produce a good manuscript.
Listen, you're writing a history of a golf course in Ohio. Do you golf?
God, no. I've torn up divots, but
that'd be the worst part of it. I've had to spend $200,000 learning to golf in order to write about this golf thing. Richard, you know how high opinion I have of you and your work, and that's why I was sort of shocked and alarmed at reading your thing on Facebook. But I now realize that it's just, you're giving up the straight job. You're giving up selling refrigerators, because I don't know if anybody's written a good book about selling refrigerators.
Well, I was going to write a good book about Sears Roebuck, but I had 13 years there, and there again, a colorful cast of characters.
Oh, I bet. The history of Sears is a fascinating, it's sort of sad
history. Yeah, a company that lost its vision, unfortunately,
yeah,
and didn't recognize the change, the new currents and trends in retailing, and I've worked for three or four different companies that have gone bankrupt and out of business. So it's nothing new, actually.
Yes, hey, you're talking to a guy who works for the Tribune, my friend. You're talking to a guy who works for the Tribune. We will see what the fate of that.
Well, Rick, thank God you're still there.
Well, it's a rough go.
It's a rough go.
Richard, it's always great to talk to you. Please, please keep me up to date on, I don't care if you're writing about a golf course, a refrigerator, or some fascinating character hidden in Chicago's history. I want to talk about it with you. And
yeah, my pleasure.
Best to all our friends at, I know you are such a great supporter of local independent bookstores, and always have been. And
yes, and I've tried to help out other writers,
yeah,
and a few people I've referred on successfully, and I guess that's what I'm most happy about.
Yeah.
So you know what, we are all in this together.
Yes,
and we got to promote each other somehow, some way.
You're right. Go to Richard Lindberg, LINDBERG.net. It's a wonderful, wonderful website. And if you spend some time at the website, then spend some time buying some of Richard's books. And I dare you to have as many on your bookshelf as I have on mine. One of the joys of my office is Richard Lindberg shelf. Richard, take care of yourself. Thanks for making an hour time on 4th of July for this. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
My pleasure.